Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Space Jams podcast. I'm your host, Jim Murphy, and today I am so honored to have with me a guest that has literally been out of this world. Now, this is a special edition of Space Jams for two reasons. One, we have a fabulous guest with us today, NASA astronaut Christina Hammett-Koch. And on the other hand, this is our first episode of Space Jams International, coming to you from Strasbourg, France. Now to give a brief introduction to our esteemed guest. Christina Koch graduated from North Carolina State University with a Bachelor of Science in Electrical Engineering and Physics and a Master of Science in Electrical Engineering. She most recently served as a flight engineer on the International Space Station for Expedition 59, 60, and 61. Koch set a record for the longest single spaceflight by a woman with a total of 328 days in space. And she is currently preparing for the upcoming Artemis missions. I would like to welcome NASA astronaut Christina Hammett-Koch.
Hey, Jim. It's great to be with you, and it's my honor, too. Thanks for the great intro.
Of course. Let's jump right in. So, starting off, that incredible feat of being in space for that duration of time. Space is no easy place to live for the mind or the body. What are the psychological impacts of not being on Earth for almost a year? And how are these things being addressed for deep space missions of the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, NASA does a lot to make sure that we are prepared psychologically for long duration space flight. But, you know, just like any good scientific organization, they've honed a lot of those countermeasures to our normal length duration mission of 6 months. So it was kind of an exciting part of my mission to help the teams on the ground learn and brainstorm ideas for how we can extend that psychological support to really cover a longer duration mission and to make it even more sustainable for even longer duration missions, hopefully to Mars in the not too distant future. So, you know, one of the things we do is we are able to have video conferences with our friends and family at home, but those conferences are regularly scheduled. And so one of the things we're looking at doing is making the astronauts be able to have a little more control over the times that they actually get to see their support network on the Earth, their friends and family in person via video chat more often and not as a scheduled thing that only happens for, you know, 1 hour every week. So that's just one example of how we are kind of learning to adapt our psychological countermeasures for long duration space flight. Another neat thing that we're doing is we have what we've affectionately named 1 year perks. So there's another astronaut on board the space station right now, my friend Mark Vandehei, who is also doing an extended duration mission. His mission will be over a year. And so he and I have had the 1 year perks, if you will. And some of those include being able to have a little more autonomy over your schedule. Right now, as you may know, our days are scheduled down to 5 minute increments. And so you literally know what you're going to be doing every single 5 minutes of the day. But for longer duration crew that have been on board for a longer amount of time, sometimes just being able to control when you might have a little more time off, being able to have some say in the types of events that you're scheduled for really goes a long way to make you feel like you are kind of just a normal functioning person in your environment and you're not so controlled every minute of the day. So there's a lot of different things. But, you know, just on a more personal note for the longer duration mission, I would say that it was that psychological aspect of it definitely was something that I wasn't sure how it would feel moving into the mission. I think different people are kind of just enjoy that environment on board the space station more than others. For me, it really wasn't that hard to extend my mission. But I did also recognize that maybe my own perception of how I was, you know, just being perceived by my peers on board could have changed just because I had been up there for so long. You know, by the end of my 11 months on board, I had only seen 11 other humans in person. And so I did things like I would ask my my crewmates for feedback and say, hey, what can I do better? What can I do differently? Because I have lost lock on what is normal interaction at this point. I've been up here for so long. So that was really nice. We had a lot of open conversations about how we could work well together. And a lot of what I learned up there was taken from my time in the Antarctic. I did a year also at the South Pole in a closed environment. So I took some of those lessons there. And the biggest one is to focus on the things that you have that you will miss that you may never have again, as opposed to the things you don't have. And that kind of mantra is really what got me through, both in the Antarctic and on board the space station.
Yeah, I think this question is definitely becoming more relevant to everyone's life because of lockdowns and things over the past couple of years. And NASA has put out ways to counter isolation and things like that. So yeah, that's some great advice. And it's very interesting to learn about the inner workings of the International Space Station.
I think another neat thing that we should incorporate for longer duration missions is an accommodation of what I call sensory underload, because I think the human mind really flourishes the best when we're constantly taking in new inputs, processing them. And that is sort of what keeps our brain in a healthy state of just, you know, kind of high functioning. And so I think bringing in a lot of different sensory inputs, whether that be, you know, module walls that can change colors or even project images, or just different having, you know, new things to open up that you haven't seen that are sort of spaced out throughout a long duration mission, can really help to kind of keep the brain alive and awake instead of waking up every day and seeing the same exact things, smelling the same things, hearing the same things.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And there's been plenty of research done on the circadian rhythm and how different cues and things and the cues of day and night are totally screwed up when you're on the International Space Station, because it's day and night every hour and a half. So that's super important. And I think a lot of people don't think about these problems when you go into space, and they're very cool to think about.
Yeah, definitely. They just recently incorporated new LED lighting on board that has three different settings. One is a kind of evening setting, a daylight setting that's very, very bright, and then sort of a mid-range setting. And it's to help us to keep not only a biological circadian rhythm, but also just kind of a mental, you know, circadian rhythm of your workday and your sort of normal routine, because you're exactly right. Sometimes the sun's shining really bright into that cupola, and sometimes it's dark out, and it's, you know, every 45 minutes it changes throughout the day. So
the ISS it's been so important for scientific research. It's been so important for access to space. Just having more people in space is always good. But it's getting older and it's having some technical problems, kind of like Hubble. It's, you know, having little glitches and things. How do you think that the retirement of the ISS will affect American space exploration and scientific research?
It's a great question. You know, right now we're looking to extend the life of the ISS out to 2030, which I am very hopeful will happen, because it is such an important platform. And, you know, with the recent announcement of Blue Origin that they're going to be creating a commercial space station, I think that, you know, we are ready to take that step to having opened up and commercialized the idea of low Earth orbit as having a commercial viability. But I definitely don't want to see a gap in that support. I want humans to always be in low Earth orbit. And so I think it's important to extend the life of ISS beyond that. And I think, you know, some of those lifetime things that we are seeing are all very much being managed right now. I don't see any of them as being to preclude going out to 2030. But to me, it's very important. I think we've shown that there's not only an interest for scientific reasons, but even for just human exploration and the desire to go out. Obviously, this year has been a banner year for different commercial space exploration of lots of different spaceflight participants, which I think is wonderful. I think everyone who has a dream to explore, anyone who's curious, is welcome in space. And so I think the more people we get up there, the better.
Yeah, I definitely agree. The idea of the orbital reef is fantastic to me. If there were some type of gap, do you think the reliance on the Chinese space station would be an option? Is that something we're thinking about?
That's a great question. Definitely not something I deal with in my day-to-day, but I think that, you know, in one sense, it's an option in the sense of it is a place where we can conduct microgravity research, or where some research is taking place. Whether or not we would partner, or some of our other partners would partner with China to allow us to kind of share that resource, something I don't necessarily have a lot of insight into. But I think, you know, the fact that the technology moves on is a good thing for the entire industry, because there's people in the aerospace industry buying these goods, keeping the industry as a whole healthy. And that means that when different people do re-enter, that industry is up and running. It kind of, it lowers any barriers to entry, you know, from when we would reinitiate LEO.
Yeah, certainly. And it seems to be a very historically accurate progression of our time in space, where it's spearheaded by the government, the public sector, and then it's being followed up and almost perfected by the private sector. So it is an interesting concept, and it's definitely the new space age.
Absolutely. And I love that was really NASA's vision 10 years ago when we started the Commercial Crew Program. You know, we recognized that NASA and other, you know, other international partners through government entities had sort of opened up the viability for the commercial option, and then had the program of doing what we see as something we've already figured out, getting astronauts and cargo to and from the space station in low Earth orbit. Let's pass that off to a nascent space industry, get them going while we look further and with the Artemis mission to things that may not yet be economically viable. But the whole idea is to kind of be an incubator, if you will, for the commercial viability of all these technologies and interests.
Yeah, I think that's such an important milestone. And I think that's a great mission for, you know, NASA to have, to be the spearhead. And that's kind of what they've always been. And it's great that they can keep that tradition going while growing the space community, which is fantastic. You know, keeping with LEO for a second, last week there was an incident involving the use of a kinetic ASAT technology in low Earth orbit. And this caused a lot of debris to be spread into orbit, posing danger to the astronauts on board the ISS, where they actually had to get into their capsules to be evacuated if necessary. How important is the mitigation of debris in Earth's orbit? Like, what dangers could it pose?
Well, it's very important. And I think one of the reasons it's important is that once things are in, you know, an orbit around the Earth that might have a conjunction with the International Space Station, there's not much you can do to get them out, or at least we haven't necessarily developed those technologies to deploy a mission that would clean up any space debris, if you will. You know, there may be some research on things like that. But so the fact that it's not something we can easily mitigate once it's there means to me it's really important for prevention. But in terms of how we handle that on board the space station day to day, we have always had procedures where if there is an expected potential conjunction, we call them, with a piece of space debris that could become an issue, the crew taking steps like closing certain hatches, getting in their vehicles that would take them home. That is all normal procedures that have been executed in the past when that's happened before. So in this case, there was an increased risk for a little bit, and we're obviously looking at what the long-term increased risks are. But it definitely affects our ability to do our jobs efficiently. Obviously, anytime we have a conjunction with space debris, it takes away from the normal work we do of, you know, keeping the space station upgraded and healthy and doing the science on board. It's also an impact when we do spacewalks. There are pop marks, if you will, all over the space station, and they're actually all marked, and we are briefed on where some of the sharp edges could be on our handholds when we do spacewalks. So that's another time when we have to really pay attention to those things and devote resources to making sure that they don't pose an additional risk. So to me, it's all about resources that could be devoted to doing, you know, the positive work that is the whole reason we have a space station, as opposed to thinking about how we can mitigate this man-made risk.
Yeah, that, wow, I had no idea. I didn't think about when you're outside of the station, which you have been, which is also incredible. I guess, like, little sidebar, how does it feel to actually be in a spacesuit in open space?
It's incredible. I think, you know, being on board the space station and looking at the cupola on the Earth, you already think it can't get any better than that. But to step outside and to see it just through your own helmet visor, and to look down and see your feet with the Earth 250 miles below, just zooming by how it looks in relative motion, is a absolutely stunning moment. And then I think the best part, though, is being out there with your friends. The moment that made it different for me wasn't when I looked down on the Earth and saw, you know, the space station and the Earth and below with no window pane in between. But it's when I actually looked out and saw Nick against that background and thought, wow, this is just me and my friend out here doing a spacewalk. It's pretty Man, incredible.
I mean, very few people ever have had that opportunity, and that's such a cool experience. I'm very jealous. Hopefully one day commercial space will allow me to do that. But we'll see. Yep, you never know.
Huge honor.
So in relation to doing research and things, you've been saying like we've done a lot of things, we're trying to get a lot of things done. What research should we be doing that we are not doing right now, in your opinion?
That's a great question. I would say it's hard for me to identify that something we should be doing that we aren't, because for the most part, the research we do up there covers a lot of ground, and it all is extremely well vetted and has a very specific purpose for either bringing a benefit back to Earth that's specific and, you know, tangible and actionable, or supporting us exploring further and deeper into the universe. So what aren't we doing? You know, and another way to think about that would be, what are some insights that I've had that might contribute to things like that? And honestly, the place where I would say I might have that additional insight is what we talked about with your first question, the long duration mission. Just having been up there, I would love to be a part of experiments that actually bring in some of the countermeasures for extreme long duration missions. And I think for that, that is something upcoming that scientists are looking at, is having year-long missions planned way in advance so that they can actually gather studies to do that. In the past, some of our year-long missions, my own and Mark Vandehei's, have been more for programmatic reasons that have come about pretty close to the mission itself. And so we haven't necessarily been able to plan for how we would deploy those experiments to study the long duration aspects of it. So that could be one area. But honestly, given that we have so many different types of experiments, you know, medical experiments, fundamental science experiments, earth science, space science, technology demonstrations, we really already kind of cover a huge, huge range.
Yeah, it's a bit of a tough question to put you on the spot. But yeah, that's a great point. I think, you know, every astronaut that goes up into space is a pioneer in human research. They have the option to not be studied, but many of them choose to be involved in some kind of research, medical research. And that is so important for moving us forward as a species.
Yeah, there's really some amazing science that you can do studying the human body when you remove kind of, or when you can consider gravity as a variable, both in human research and fundamental science research. You realize the things that we have taken as, fact, that were actually just a result of our gravity field, specific to Earth. So it's really stunning research.
Now, you touched on the microgravity a little bit in LEO. You know, we've got the Earth's magnetic field protecting us from things, and that's different. So even studies we do in LEO aren't going to necessarily be the same as the effects we would see in deep space, like on moon missions or on Mars missions. And I know it's been your dream since you were a kid to become an astronaut. And how do you feel about the possibility of being the first woman to step foot on the moon? Being the first person to step on Mars, is that a possibility? Or how does it feel?
Well, you know, as an astronaut, you're absolutely right. I've already achieved way more than I ever thought I could of my childhood dream to become an astronaut. It's been an just incredible career. What I've been able to contribute to and the teams I've been a part of have just been phenomenal. And just the possibility that I am still in the astronaut corps and an active astronaut at the time of Artemis is an extreme honor. It's an inspiration, and it's, you know, a reason to really, really keep mission focused to make sure that I'm ready to carry out those duties if they were to happen. But I like to say that I'm just excited I will know the first or the next people on the moon, because they're coming out of a cadre of all just extremely qualified and wonderful people and astronauts. So it is an extreme honor and an inspiration. But any way that I can give back to the program is really what I'm looking for at this point. It's just such an amazing time to be a part of human spaceflight.
It's an amazing time to be alive, just witnessing all these things. I mean, the space industry is changing so much, and it's really fantastic. So the token question from Space Chams is, what is your favorite book and why should people read it?
I will talk generally, if that's okay, because I can't necessarily endorse a single book. But what I can tell you is that, you know, my favorite books are books about human innovation and exploration and grit, working through something that is just insurmountable or seemingly insurmountable at first. So just a couple examples of books like that. Roots by Alex Haley is one of my favorite books of all time. Just explaining the journey that of that family is just absolutely epic and phenomenal. Endurance is a book about the Shackleton story that I absolutely love. Books about, one of the really inspiring books I read was about a young woman who circumnavigated the world in a sailboat. So you kind of sense the theme here. Stories about people that just are inspiring because they reach beyond what they think that they can do and overcome completely, you know, overcome the odds, overcome insurmountable tasks. And that is what I just love reading about. And I actually draw upon often in my time, both in space and in training, and just remembering that people have done amazing things by, you know, never doubting the fact that if you strive farther, you actually can find kind of in a whole new level of performance, of inspiration, and you can really not only give the most back to the world, but get the most out of whatever's in front of you.
Wow. I mean, drop the mic.
Mic drops in space are really fun, by the way. The mic just stays there. I'm really missing that.
Oh my God. Well, Christina, thank you so much for joining us today. It was an absolute pleasure. And we know that Turkey Day coming up, Thanksgiving tomorrow, and I know it's a tight schedule here, so even more thank yous.
Thank you so much. Yeah, great questions. It was really great to chat with you and to share a little bit about what we're doing over here at Johnson Space Center.
For one last time, a huge thank you to NASA astronaut Christina Hammack-Koch. Happy Thanksgiving. If you enjoyed this episode, you enjoyed our content, follow us on Instagram, I don't know, YouTube. Follow us everywhere at Space Chams. And always remember to keep looking up.